thank you. Mr. Senior, quick confession. Good afternoon, everyone. It's a rather small crowd, informal crowd, so we really don't have to be too fancy this afternoon. I think everyone, just about everyone, knows who I am. For the few who don't, I'm Samuel Ayer. Let me say preliminarily that we here at Dilworth are just very pleased to have you here and to have a Middle East Forum as our guest and to be able to present another one of our very notable and good speakers. So if any of you want to move this way, you can, but I see the seats have all been pretty much filled up. We have an excellent speaker this afternoon. Many of you have already met him. I'm going to ask Tom Trump to introduce him, and after that, Colonel Rutter will give his presentation and has consented to answer questions. And although his talk is going to be primarily about the military exploit of his experience in Iraq, he's told me that he would entertain questions of a political nature, diplomatic nature, or anything of that sort. I think, unfortunately, a lot of people may have had him mixed up with Scott Ritter, one of those unfortunate mix-ups. I guess it's a good fortune of our country and of the world that there are Scott Rutters. Tom, would you please introduce...
Thank you, Sam. Yes, indeed, after a short while, I'm able to attest to the fact that you are a good guy, and therefore it is an additional pleasure to introduce you. But first of all, I think most of you do know that I'm Tom Trope. I'm a member of the Board of Governors of the Middle East Forum. As I said, it's going to be my great pleasure to introduce Scott Rutter, but in the meantime, or first of all, what I'd like to do is thank Dilworth and our friend Sam Lair for hosting this event. Number two, I'd like to make the customary announcement, which I will make emphatically because my own pet peeve, and that is, please turn off all cell phones. Don't just put them on vibrate mode. Turn them off. Don't answer them if you make a mistake, so we can give our full attention to the speaker. I'd like to proceed with my introduction of Scott Rutter. And by the way, I do mention that after Colonel Rutter speaks, there will be a question and answer session, and Sam Lair will conduct that. Scott Rutter is recently retired from a very distinguished career in the United States Army. In fact, I think it's very important to take note of the fact that Scott Rutter is a decorated combat veteran. Most recently, he served with the 2nd Battalion, 7th Infantry Regiment, and which since 1996 has been part of the 3rd Infantry Division. Lieutenant Colonel Rutter commanded, as I have it here, the 2-7 Infantry. He can tell me if that's correct. 2-7 Infantry, as Rutter's 850-man unit is known, and he was there for the hard-fought capture of the Saddam International Airport, and that victory paved the way for the coalition forces' subsequent capture of Baghdad, which we all watched. The 2-7 Infantry was the most decorated combat unit of its kind in Iraq, and as I mentioned before, Scott Rutter is a highly decorated combat veteran. He won the Bronze Star for Valor in the 1991 Gulf War, and he won the Silver Star for gallantry in action in this most recent war. And I will add a personal note, and that is, I have long believed that for those of us who enjoy this wonderfully comfortable and secure existence in Philadelphia or wherever else we may take ourselves, it is, if you stop to think about it, really thanks to people like Scott Rutter that we can enjoy what we have. And so just myself, I would I do take this opportunity to say to you, Scott Rutter, I thank you for your service to our country. And now join me in welcoming Scott Rutter.
to be back in Philadelphia. I've been out of Baghdad since 15 June. Most of my discussion, which we're going to have, and I got a couple interactive interactive items here that I'll use video to talk about, a little bit about the train-up that we had, and then I'll talk about the actual specific training and the events that led up to the actual capture. The security of central Baghdad, the banking and financial district, was my area that I was specifically identified to take care of, as well as the challenges of what's about to come. I've been speaking all over the place. Yesterday I was with John Moody with Fox up at Seton Hall, so I've got a lot of great questions from the students there, been at Penn and a couple other places. So after this is over, I'd be more than willing to answer any type of question that you may have. I had the honor to lead 850 of America's best. Okay, from all walks of life, you know, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, Guam, the Virgin Islands, California, Alaska. Unbelievable. Unbelievable acts of gallantry, heroism, valor. Unfortunately, I did not bring home 10 soldiers, 35 seriously wounded. They understood the mission and what needed to be done when America asked us to execute it. We understood what was important September 11th. I was in my training room executing a training meeting that we had when our intelligence officer or the intelligence non-commissioned officer came in and interrupted the meeting and said, sir, you've got to come in and take a look at the actual television. You know, to this belief, I think we all saw the pillars of our strength, the World Trade Centers with airplanes sticking out of them. Unbelievable acts of hard work and heroism by the police and firemen of New York City and throughout Pennsylvania and the Pentagon throughout this disaster for what has happened. Well, it all became too personal at that point, and the soldiers that I had the honor to lead realized that was our starting point for what was yet to come. What I'll do is I'll talk a little bit about that train-up. How long did it actually took for us to prepare to go into Baghdad International Airport? You know, and I will tell you, for 1 year before we departed, I studied Baghdad International Airport. I could tell you how many urinals were in the bathroom or how many commodes specifically, how high the fences were, how many steps were in the actual control tower. So a lot of detail, a lot of preparation, a lot of focus. Our families didn't know. My wife didn't know for probably about 3 months before we actually left for what was actually happening and what was happening. We went through a dynamic training event which built confidence in the soldiers. This generation, you'll hear me go back to 18 to 25. When they speak now, I take notes. Unbelievable. We don't hear about the individuals shooting their bosses, shooting the platoon leaders, shooting the company commanders. They're over there with a purpose. They understand the purpose. We understand, we have a hard time, especially in June, coming back and hearing the bad things that are publicized in the events that's in the media and the press. I had the honor to have two world-class reporters with me, embedded in with me. Michael Corkery from the Providence Journal also handled Spokane, Washington, some other areas, Louisville, and some other small town, Sacramento, California, and Carolyn Glick from the Jerusalem Post, embedded with me, saw the horrors of combat, were present with me when four of my heroes, all 850 of them were heroes, but four of my heroes perished the day on March 22nd when the car bomb, the taxi cab bomb, came off of one of my blocking positions. And I'll talk about that a little bit. It's touching. The word privilege is not enough. Honored to command those great leaders. I left at the top. I left leading soldiers, and that's what I call the top. And I had a great career, and I'm welcome to be back into Philadelphia, my native city. My father was a police officer, grandfather was a police officer, and I'm proud to be a Philadelphian. So, the unsung heroes, part of my introduction, unsung heroes were the family members, the moms and dads, the grandparents. You think I had it hard? How do you handle six weeping widows at Fort Stewart, Georgia, with my wife and my 1 and 3 year old? And how do you handle the information flow of individuals that have lost legs, that were seriously burned and passing that down? But we all work together. We worked as a team. from all walks of life, and we brought families to make things better. We understood the commitment and still understand the commitment as we support our country's contribution to the war against terror, as well as our great president that I back 100%. I have no, you know, I am completely out of the Army. I don't answer any questions that concerning, you know, any type of political question from a guy that was actually there. Next slide. We're going to follow a couple things here. I'll go away from the scripted portion of the speech here. A little bit of an agenda that we'll walk through. I have a video that'll show you some of the train-up that we actually have during the actual preparation. Talk a little bit about the deployment. Where were we when we were alerted? Then I'll go into our mission, our concept. Show you a little bit about the terrain. Be able to articulate some of the challenges that we had with terrain, and I call it challenge because it really wasn't a problem. Could you imagine? You know, 21 days it took us to get to Baghdad. Unbelievable. 5 January, I was with my family in Philadelphia. 22nd of January, I was combat ready, threw my equipment, our equipment for my unit, you know, and we, I don't know the I word, but we were ready to launch into Iraq on January 22nd. No other civilization in the world could do that. For us to have the infrastructure that we have now, for us to take, you know, those items that were there in the Cold War, in Germany, put on ship, and design a force projection army that I could have 2 sets of equipment, or we could have 2 sets of equipment. One in Fort Stewart, where we trained part of the 3rd Infantry Division, and another set on ships throughout the Pacific and throughout the Middle East and the Atlantic in case, you know, the inevitable did happen. That's basically the deployment frame of threat. I'll talk a little bit about the enemy. What did I see? How many did I see? What did we fight? What did we encounter? What do I think that we saw, you know, from my analysis, and I'll talk about the actual execution, intermediate objective. Objective lion is what we call Baghdad International Airport. That was a decisive point. Very important strategically for understanding certain events that we would have, you know, that would cause the capitulation of the actual regime. That was one of them. I think we all saw Baghdad Bob when he said they're not at the airport, and then you saw another guy on the other side of the television saying we're at the airport. That was me announcing on AP that we were at Baghdad International Airport. Let me lighten everybody up real quick. Okay. Before I go on. I get a call from Fox and MSNBC once in a while to actually elaborate on some information, and Fox called me up the day that the brothers were killed. Everybody remember that day, the day that the brothers were killed? And what happened was that, you know, the brothers were killed, and there were some other events, and they said, Scott, so what do you think about this day? You know, I was watching the news earlier on Fox trying to figure out what to say, and I'm giving my analysis from Little Wixie, Georgia. Anybody ever remember Little Wixie, Georgia, making the route down the 301? You know, don't get out of the car, you'll get a traffic ticket. But anyway, that's where I was, you know, calling in the Fox, and we were talking about that. And they asked me, the analyst, forget his name, and he said, what do you think about today? I said, well, 3 great things happened for America. And this was, you know, this was about 2 months ago, so I'm taking tongue-in-cheek a little bit. I said, number one, we got the brothers. You know, they're dead, they're captured, whatever, they're actually dead. Number two is Jessica Lynch got her medal. Obviously, you know, back then we thought, you know, thought things were a little bit different. And number 3, the Eiffel Tower is on fire. So anyway, that was, did you remember that day or what? So pretty interesting, you know, how that happened. But again, you know, full commitment by our soldiers, full commitment by our country, and I think the rest of the world, our great friends, the British, stepping up to the plate, and other countries throughout Europe and around the United, you know, around the world have actually stepped up to the plate. And I'm proud to have worked hand in hand with them. Then I'll talk a little bit about the security operations in central Baghdad, and then I'm going to talk about one here. I'll talk about that now, and you'll see where I lead into. Audie Murphy, everybody hear Audie Murphy?
Yeah.
Sergeant First Class Paul Smith. Do we know him?
No.
Well, go figure. You know, it's not headlines, not sensational. Let me tell you about Sergeant First Class Smith. Sergeant First Class Smith is the only individual that will be nominated for the Congressional Medal of Honor in Iraqi freedom. I watched him die. He served in my unit. He was an engineer platoon sergeant. The day was April 4th when we were attacking at Baghdad International Airport. When we got in there under the cover of darkness, nothing happened. You know, go on the defense, brother. No, the best defense is an offense. 3 multiple series of attacks over 3 days from April 4th to April 7th, we fought. We didn't know where the enemy was. The intelligence was a cloud event. They ran off the runway. We got there. We executed our mission and received a counterattack right in the center of my battalion headquarters as we were actually attacking. We was back there, executed unheard of acts of bravery. I mean, now this is the guy jumping from vehicles that are on fire, throwing the hand grenades, machine guns, last words before he got evacuated back to the aid station where we attempted to save his life was, you know, do not let the ammunition run out. That was his last words. Why aren't we hearing about that? Okay, interesting. I brought that up last night with the media. There are good news stories out there, and that's, you know, unfortunately, he's gone. His family is in St. Petersburg, Florida. They're receiving their $900 a month for the rest of his life, and he was given a check for $250,000 for his service. So, next slide. And just hit the arrow left and right. A deployment. Fort Stewart, close to Savannah, Georgia. Anybody ever been to Savannah? Beautiful city. You ever get a chance to go there? Has a very large port there. You know, Renault cars from France, you know, came there. And they built a port in the 70s there. Bottom line, we had to take some of our equipment. Some of our equipment that we took was the new equipment that we received, the new vehicles, the new type of navigational systems, the SETS kits, analysis radios that we brought over in order to join our second set of equipment. Some of the division was already over there. Again, the division was basically already over there. The two brigades were already over there. Our brigade came in last because we were scheduled to rotate over to Iraq in April. So since the end of the 1991 war, there's been a rotation requirement in order to maintain a battalion's worth of infrastructure over there. In the event that Saddam acted up, we would be able to rapidly build up the area to get there. So you can imagine the first week of January, about 3,000 people there. You can imagine the end of January, 50,000 people there. So you can just imagine there were haves and have-nots, you know, which you see on MASH, and you know, people running around trying to get equipment, trying to get parts. Lots of challenges, you know. I'm not going to hold back to turn the supplies and parts and everything like that. But we did it, and we were able to work through those systems to work out this new type of concept that we had with force projection. This is some of the fleet, the RoRo fleet that we actually put our vehicles on, and that's how we did that, getting out of there. About 10% of our equipment deployed at Fort Stewart, Georgia. Next slide. Okay, here's what the actual ship, some of the port operations that were there. This happened basically during mid-December. We shipped all our equipment out. 22 days later, it was there and ready to be downloaded by our advanced parties that were already on site to link up with the other ships that came in from Diego Garcia to have other sets of equipment. Next slide. Again, when we got there, like I said, what this says is hell, 0 miles, population too many. You can imagine a structure of, you know, made for 2,000-3,000 people now being inundated with 50,000 people all at once. So again, like I said, there were haves and have-nots. Next slide. Oh, you know, some time for entertainment, not entertainment, but, you know, I mean, I realized that, you know, having seen the face of war before, and I served in the 1st Infantry Division during the First War, I understood that morale was very important. The second thing that I realized was that the lead soldiers being confident in their weapon systems and confident in their abilities and actually being part of the solution, very important, in fact, to get better results when it's like that. So this is one of my assistant operations officers enjoying the time as we were actually building up. And this is our latrine. This is Creature Comfort in Kuwait. After we left here, completely primitive. That's a shower up on top. They come up and fill the water, and you get a shower. You can get a minute, you know, and we put some immersion heaters in there that the coach would have, so we tried everything to make things a little bit better. Next slide. That's what that looks like. That's the tactical operations center of an infantry battalion. Let me just digress here and talk about an infantry battalion. My battalion was a task force. It was about 850 soldiers. What a task force is when a battalion goes to combat, what it does is it basically, I guess, other units from different, you know, a sundry of other units from an advanced life-saving trauma team that we had. We had thoracic surgeons, emergency room surgeons with me in order to, you know, in order to crack a chest to get in there. We had attorneys that could tell me that I can't do this in town or whatever, you know, and do certain things or make sure that we understood the rules of engagement. And then we had, you know, individuals from the Air Force, chemical units, and so forth. So all of this group came together. This is the Battalion Operations Center. This is headed by the Battalion Exodo. While I'm up fighting the war back in Bradley, they're making the plans and developing different courses of actions while we actually fight. Within there, there's various types of downlink systems where we can actually get information from satellites and, you know, information throughout the whole spectrum of the Department of Defense for us to talk. Us to talk directly. In fact, we even had navigational systems on our vehicles. In my Bradley, I had, what do they call that in a car, NASCAR, where I could actually see the roads. I had all the roads in Baghdad. I could plug in, you know, different roads. I could type email to a friend of mine that was in Afghanistan. I mean, so that the technology was there, and that was a combat contributor. That saved lives for us to have that situational awareness, prevented fratricide. And there was some fratricide throughout the entire Army and the Air Force and the Navy. But, you know, we were able to use those in order to help us. Now, let me just talk real quick, you know, about that group coming together. That group that came together of 850 soldiers took us about a year to go through a gate training strategy as we built up understanding what we needed to do. We needed to destroy the Republican Guard at Baghdad International Airport. We needed to get there. We needed to understand the terrain. We needed to drive on certain roads, knowing that, you know, there's different bridges that do not take us. We know we're going to be going through ambushes. We know we're going to be going through narrow roads and so forth. And what we did on that game training strategy, we actually worked at the squad level, 9-10 soldiers, up to 100, you know, sort of a gate training strategy throughout a year that we let soldiers be part of that training strategy and actually train and have the opportunity to go to the field, work the individual skills and the collective skills. The capstone exercise before we left was an event at the National Training Center. I got a quick video here I'll show you real quick. And it talks about, it doesn't really talk, it'll show you the training capabilities of what the Army has and what we use when we go out to the Mojave Desert and we train in a training area about the size of the state of Rhode Island and all the technical aspects that are overwatching us that can provide downlinks, you know, photographs, observer controllers that are out there actually observing us, the after-action review process that we actually use during that time frame. So let me just pull this out here. We actually knew at this point, we knew we were going. So if we could just move that, I have no idea. So with that. Yeah. Well, this was put together by a public affairs office because they wanted to put some time in for the soldiers. Very important. The morale was very, very, very important. This is an active part. It's something you care. Second time in 7th Infantry. Andrew Jackson was the first commander. General Pat used this in 1942. Target. Okay, that was the product that we got before we left of our rotation. Let's go back to the show here real quick and I'll get back to it. So we knew we were going to, you know, we ran it for the start. You know, and again, as I said, you know, being at the tip of the spear, knowing that we were going to be at the tip of the spear, how do you motivate soldiers that are going to, you know, some are going to lose their lives? And, you know, I tell you what, we all work together. And bringing soldiers together, making them feel part of the solution and be part of the actual planning was very important to me, you know, from my experience in the first, you know, the first Gulf War to be part of it. So we need to go to the slideshow. I'll keep talking while we're going. But basically, you know, our mission was twofold. Destroy the Republican Guard at Central Baghdad. Destroy one brigade of the Medina Division at the crossing site along the Euphrates River. We understood those two main objectives. After that, unclear. We knew that we had, we were going to go into the city. We needed to develop the situation a little bit because there was an escalating requirement in order for us to, have some time outside the city before we actually went in there in order to develop the actual plan for us to go in the city. What happened? It went a lot quicker. There was a period that we could take advantage and seize the initiative for us to get in there to actually have less lives lost. And I believe that was very successful for us to take advantage of that. The challenge is now is, you know, there's a soldier killed every day. There's a soldier killed every other day. Do I feel, in my opinion, that if we didn't take advantage of going into Baghdad right away, that we would have had more soldiers killed? A lot more. A lot more. But, you know, when you're on the initiative and you're on the offense and you're taking the enemy's advantage away by not allowing him to make any decisions, you have the advantage. And that's, you know, I applaud the leadership of the Army as they continued and execute their mission throughout right now. Many challenges. We hear a lot of people that are upset, you know, the guys are getting picked off and so forth. But I'm proud to say today and last night that Operation Iron Hammer continues. Three cities throughout Iraq and, you know, I mean, they're being targeted for Saddam loyalists. Artillery is being used for the first time in many months, many weeks out there in order for us to execute those things. The more that you're on the offense, the better. Now, somebody will ask me, do we need more troops there? Well, I sort of look at it this way. I went to the airport. I was a supporting effort. My battalion was a supporting effort. Block enemy penetrations coming in from Baghdad into the airport. You can imagine the access road. Anybody ever been to Dulles Airport? Yeah, that long access road. Imagine that long access road coming in from Baghdad. You had to have a pass to go on there, and it wasn't an easy pass in order to get into, you know, in order to use that road. Okay, so you had to be a special person in order to use that road. So bottom line is that when we went there and we were on the offense, there was nothing on the runway. You know, the only thing that was on the runway was leftover equipment from the air defense threat. They left. They knew that we were concentrating on the runway. So we were the supporting effort. My battalion was the supporting effort that we had to destroy the Republican Guard off the airfield along the access road. And that's when I spoke about the three-pronged attack as we actually attacked and went down into Baghdad International Airport. What happened during that time frame, a lot of people asked me, well, you were the only guys fighting. We were the only guys fighting during that time frame. My brigade was on the runway securing the airport. You know, my guys were down actually hooking and jabbing. Anybody seen the handheld missile being fired, you know, on Fox and the other channels that actually hit the tank? I had a picture I'll show you once we get this set up that is actually the actual picture of that, you know, of that tank being engaged. And that was, you know, that was from our unit that was attacked there. Now somebody will ask, well, if you were the only individuals fighting, wouldn't it have been better if we'd given you another unit or another unit came to assist you?
Absolutely not.
I had enough capability in order to accomplish that mission. I couldn't imagine if another unit was brought in order to help me, and the amount of confusion and the collaboration that wasn't planned in order to do it. So the answer is, do we have enough soldiers there? Absolutely. I'm convinced that the more that we're on the offense, the nights like last night and the night before of us executing our mission, very, very, very important. So that's the airport. Three attacks down the side of the access road going into the actual airport. Not working out. Could get that gentleman that was here earlier helping us out if that's possible. So I'm going to get that. And we could see a little bit about the pictures. I would hate to, hate not to show that to you. So I'm sorry.
I apologize.
Yeah. Move the whole computer off. It's okay. We can adjust accordingly. Move the screen off. Better. There you go. Who's the engineer?
Okay.
This mission statement, as I said, we'll go through a lot of these I already talked about. Next slide. Right arrow. And this is, three objectives as we went 375 kilometers, about 280 miles cross country. We lost the soldier and we lost the Bradley in route. Even with the night vision goggles and the technology that we had, with some, a swimming pool, a dike, was life threatening. Next slide. This is what the desert looked like throughout when we immediately crossed. I'll show you some terrain of what it looked like a little bit different as we go on, as we actually got to Baghdad and got across the Euphrates. Next slide. This is what it looked like when we crossed and we were actually moving out of Kuwait and into Iraq. You can imagine as far right as you can see, as far left as you can see, were actually combat vehicles. But it was a narrow front. Okay, we took risks, not a gamble, in order to penetrate. Outside that 5 to 7 mile buffer area that we had was no man's land. So those truck drivers, those units that got lost making a wrong turn left, they fell into harm's way. Non-linear battlefield we're fighting, okay? Because we're using, our technology and our strength of the individual soldiers in the units to penetrate into a specific area, and that's what happened with the truck drivers and the individuals that took a wrong turn or went left. I get lost in King of Prussia when I drive out there. I don't know how everybody else. I can't figure out 202. Don't follow the signs of Philadelphia or I'm in debt. So anyway, next slide. Like any training event, once we got there, January 25th, lots of time in order to rehearsal. I'm in order for us to rehearse. Rehearse, rehearse, rehearse. Very important for us to do that, into building confidence, and that's what it was all about in order to make sure these guys knew that they were comfortable in what we're doing. 850 guys in the desert, 300 vehicles, we set up a gigantic sand table about a mile by a mile, and went through the actual attack, how we were going to do it, what was going to happen, what was the next event, and so on and so on. Next slide. Wow, that's me. I look a little bit different there, but anyway, that's why that looked mean. But anyway, what we did is we gathered the horses. Next slide. After action reviews were executed in order for us to identify those things that we needed to work on and continually to improve on. Not me talking the entire time. Getting the soldiers and the leaders to identify their their shortcomings and making them part of the solution. That was something that I picked up. Next slide. Multifaceted threat. Just briefly on the threat real quick. You know, three-dimensional. You know, we had that. And the conventional forces, the Iraqi rebel army that basically gave up in the south. We had another type of threat, the paramilitary. These guys were probably college guys, rich family, in Baghdad, giving $10,000 to go down and fight. You know, they were part of the reservists. We, you know, the ones that we killed in Al Samawa, when we searched their bodies, they had, you know, thousands of dollars of bills in their pockets and pictures, you know, personal pictures of Saddam Hussein. So somebody motivated these individuals in order to come down to work with the Shiite Muslims that were the majority of the conventional force. So the Sunnis and the Shiites working hand in hand, or with the Sunni with a gun on the back of the neck of the Shiite in order to attempt to destroy us, which they failed drastically. Matter of fact, just one vignette here, real quick. We came up to the town, first contact. Okay, it was an ambush. Bullets flying, scout platoon. Just hearing the fear in our scout platoon leader's voice as we were going down this road. Sort of like about the size of Roosevelt Boulevard. So there was a town. You know, there was a town. They were firing from the town, mixed in the signals. You know, mixed in the civilians. They were actually firing. So we had to handle it. Well, these guys thought they were smart. I mean, the town was bright lights, street lights, everything like that. You know, was actually there. You know, you can imagine what it sounds like. They turn the lights out, okay? And, you know, you'll get the rest of the story here. Thank God no one was killed that day. But when you turn the lights out, oh, that's our baby. You know, I mean, we could see everything. They were, like, sneaking, thinking that we didn't see them. I mean, it was all over at that point. So that was the town of El Samawa. Then the other one was support and stability operations. I have some pictures here that you'll see that'll have what it looked like, the chaos that came through after all these, you know, all the individuals were there with their homes destroyed and their, you know, their vehicles being looted and so forth. You'll see some pictures there. Next slide. Soldier lost his life here. How do you see that when you're driving at night? So, one soldier lost his life here, three seriously wounded inside that rally. That's about 20 foot deep. Couldn't see it driving at night. The risk that we took going through at night. And one soldier cursed. Next one. Public affairs, very important for us to have that, as well as civil affairs. We had our linguists and our translators were with us at loudspeaker and talk from, you know, here to probably Veterans Stadium. So, I mean, it's pretty loud. Next slide. Unopposed border crossing. We, 3 days before, the border evacuated. All the UN soldiers were actually left. We brought up Pakistani contractors, knocked down the fence. Everybody laughs about that. Contractors. You know, the Gulf Wars are the two wars that America used the least amount of contractors. And the Civil War was the largest one, and, you know, and World War One. Not a lot of people realize that. It's in our, you know, it's in our way. Small standing armies, you know, large militia, you know, same thing. We've since the 1700s. Next slide. Multiple engagements, multiple lanes coming through the fences. That's what the UN fence looked like when we actually went through it. Next slide. You see a side view of the actual fence. Went around the whole country. So different, you know, minefields throughout, but we were able to clear the lanes going through. Next slide. One of our soldiers got a flag as we actually went across, sort of motivational inspiration to us as the entire division and our specific battalion went by. Next one. Key task to beat the 11th Infantry Division, which was located along the Euphrates River, for us to gain crossing sites along the Euphrates River, and for us to execute and seize Talil Air Force Base, destroy the Medina Division, and then up to Baghdad International Airport, which was objective line. You know, you can spin through these pretty quick. Next slide. Next slide. Next slide. Next slide. Real quick, what happened was the Marines, everyone remembers, the Marines came up along the Tigris over here in the east. The 3rd Division came up on the western side. Our brigade, or my battalion, our brigade, or our battalion, was the main effort. So all of those initial fights against the Iraqi conventional units in the south and those units throughout the entire south, the Karbala Gap, and so forth, were done by other units in order for us to stable our combat power in order to launch going into objective line. Now, objective line was our brigade objective. Again, as I said, we were supporting effort, which was basically to block enemy counterattacks from Baghdad International Airport. Usually the senior battalion becomes the supporting effort. Brigade commander's not with me. The brigade commander's fighting the main effort. Nothing was on the runway. And the fight came down from the actual eastern side as we went down and destroyed 10 B-72s, that's 25 BMPs, and I would say probably about 600 Iraqi soldiers died there. Next slide.
Next slide. Next slide. All the crossing sites. Next slide.
And one more. Okay. Everyone remember the first slide that I showed you with the sand and everything? As we got closer to the Euphrates, it sort of started looking like Orlando, Florida, a little bit different. In fact, we had some vehicles that came off the ship. You know, about 10% of them were painted green. I got a young soldier saying, God, I'm going to die because, you know, my vehicle's not staying green. When he got up there, he was happy his vehicle was green. You know, the other guys were sand and putting bushes on it. So it's quite a coincidence. Great picture from one of our public affairs as we were coming off the Euphrates on the other side. Next slide. Now, the bridges were rigged with dynamite. Our special forces were able to get in there. Neutralize the Iraqi soldiers that were guarding the bridges, you know, which were going to detonate the bridges, and we basically did a unopposed river crossing.
Yeah.
Or opposed, you know, opposed by direct fire, but not the bridges were standing. We did put down the bridges that we had in order to make sure that if later on the bridges went down, that we were able to pass some sort of crossing site. That's the same technology, those bridges that's been used in Bosnia and in World War II, that's been around for a while. Next slide. Kabbalah Gap, we spoke about that, the narrow gap, about 7 kilometers, we thought that was it. You know, as we were getting ready in the desert, we were gathering our equipment, making sure that we had all of our maintenance done, and we had all of the contributive actions done before we launched. And you know, we took a lot of bad press about that. Oh, they're stuck in the desert and so forth. But you know, there's a difference between speed and tempo. You know, speed is speed, and tempo is methodical thought process involved in it with different decisions identified with that in order to make a decision. So there were some things that we wanted to do in order before we got in there. Obviously, diplomatic action was one thing. Second thing was that the Air Force, the bombing, the artillery, in order to get ready. This war was different from 91, and in this interesting perspective, among many others, is that the strategic action happened after the Tango operation launched. We attacked before the Air Force bombed. Element of surprise. What a novel concept compared to the first war, you know, 30 days of bombing and then, you know, this methodical thought process. But this gave us a marked advantage. Probably some of the decisions Saddam Hussein made was probably tied to that. Next slide. And next slide, next slide, next slide, and next slide. And one more. One more. And, okay. As we came out of the Kabbalah Gap, our brigade went to the airport. The southern part of Baghdad, you can imagine coming from Harrisburg and attacking in the Norris town, that's Baghdad International Airport, and the southern approach via Exington. Everybody know what I'm talking about now? You know, a little bit? Okay, so one brigade down in Exington attacking towards the north. That's the second brigade. First Brigade attacking into the airport. That was basically the plan for us to get into the airport, for 2nd Brigade to be set at a key intersection, 276 and 95, in order to secure that for us to go in and launch once we actually had a stage or a platform for Baghdad. Battle of the Overpass. Three heroes there executing combat operations as we engaged, you know, 10 T-72s. Hundreds and, you know, countless of Iraqi soldiers that attempted to fight to the very end. Next slide. As we went down, this is that access road going all the way into Baghdad. This is like right before, you know, the ramps going to like the departure and the the arrival center right there. It's right behind. That overpass is basically, you know, that road that takes you to the top, you know, the drop-off point and the underneath point and so forth. As we went down, the engineers would clear the roads in order to make sure that no one was hiding behind the trees and roads. I didn't care. I only cared for one thing. I cared about my soldiers. The most important thing. If something was in the way, it moved. If something was moving and was not wearing an American uniform and it was in Iraq, he was dead. No questions asked. I left in the middle of May. If it was 12 o'clock at night and it was past curfew and there was a soldier walking down the street in Iraqi civilian with an AK-47 on his back at night past curfew, don't even call me, guys. Don't even call me to tell me to identify them. Call me when they're dead. Okay? So that's the latitude that we gave our soldiers. Next slide. This is the remains of one of my rallies was hit by a T-76. You hear this one, you know, you hear a little bit, but it's kind of, you know, one of my rallies got hit. That's the side bags that basically exploded once the impact. Now let me talk about that a little bit. And then we'll move on here. The Bradley was hit when we got to the airport. That's the fire engine, you know, behind the airport. This is the access road coming in. That's Saddam Hussein back there. Pictures all over. He's like George Washington in the classroom. Every, you know, there'd be a picture of him in here if this was Iraq. So pretty interesting. This Bradley was hit by a T-72 tank that was over the other side about maybe 1,000 meters away. Or 800 meters away. The dismounted infantry were not in that Bradley. Those individuals were ground-mounted, holding the Javelin missile, getting back to the example that I said when that exploded. Well, they saw that Bradley did it. Got it. The driver, the gunner, and the Bradley commander were thrown out of the Bradley. They were okay. They walked away from it. But I'll show you what the Bradley looked like. Next slide. This is the tank that hit it. So, you know, this is from a low angle, not from the overpass, but those guys got really mad when they saw their Bradley get hit. They fired a fire-and-forget missile that attacked and actually hit, you know, hit the tank. You know, the guy didn't even know the tank next to him, you know, he was next. You know, can you hear me now? He was next, and he was like, look, where did that come from? Was the Javelin missile? Goes up, and then comes down. Has no idea where it's coming from. Next slide. Wow, that's that tank. Amazing, isn't it? You know, that's the kind of what it looks like after it was hit by that handheld missile. Next slide. Throughout the access road, minefields throughout, you know, that we had to clear as we went into Baghdad. Next slide. And this is the Minister of Information location that we had, and we used precision guided missiles in order to destroy the information minister in his building. Bottom line, I had no constraints on when I could use aircraft or not. So, I mean, if someone was shooting out of there, I used every means that was, you know, within my hands and capable, you know, that I was capable to use in order to use. Next slide. Three guys, three heroes, up 3 days from April 3rd to April 6th, fired consistently down the access road as we continued to attack. Next slide. This is the Bradley. That's the penetration point of the T-72 main tank round. Again, you know, the plastic cap on the round, the penetrator's about that big. It's like a narrow pencil. And when it goes inside the Bradley, next slide, that's what it looks like. You know, could you imagine if someone was in the back there? It basically rips it apart. The Bradley was actually picked up and moved about 15 feet. So, I mean, you can imagine the kinetic energy with that. Next slide. As we went into Baghdad, Central Baghdad, you see where the airport is. The access road that I was talking about was right here. We were ready to launch from there. 2nd Brigade was still in the south down here, down in Essington or down in Norristown or whatever, you know, to imagine the distance. 3 days we fought there to April 6th. April 6th, the 101st Airborne Division caught up with us. And what happened then is that they relieved my unit because we were the only one fighting. I had about 20 guys injured at that point there, shot, you know, burns and so forth throughout. So they relieved us, put it in part of the brigade reserve back at the airfield. 6 hours into the mission, rudder, Redcon 1, move your battalion now. You need to help 2nd Brigade.
We moved in bad guy territory. This is April 7th from here all the way down here. Now this was, you know, this was like no man's land. So we're
driving with the NASTAR getting there. We put the scouts out, had the digital recon, used the Air Force in order to guide us in, give us good reconnaissance of the actual routes, and we moved down to a second brigade, made, you know, this is April 6th, my call sign, Task Force 27, now attached to second brigade, your order, sir. So at that point, my battalion went on the Thunder Runs into central Baghdad as part of the actual run secure into central Baghdad, going in there in order to use the initiative, taking advantage away from the actual Iraqis for us to get in there without having to do hand-to-hand street fighting consistently. The price is what we have now, obviously, but I tell you, if we didn't do that, things would be different. Next slide. And that's the brigade basically coming in. Next slide. Next slide. Third brigade went up to the north, objective Titans, in order to isolate Baghdad from the north. First brigade, objective Lions. Second brigade attacking into Baghdad, all the regime district that we were part of, and so forth. The one item that I was able to take back, I had a choice between one of Saddam Hussein's uniforms or the actual flag at the Special Republican Guard headquarters at the airport. This was presented to me by my soldiers. It wasn't a frame, but hey, I'm a long C-130 flight back. You can imagine what it looked like when it came back. So I sort of carried it around, gotten through the Department of Agriculture, still with the dust. Don't throw me in or whatever. Next slide, we'll talk about Baghdad. Okay, this is coming up from the south. M1 tank is a Nissan pickup truck. Guess what? Can you hear me now? So next slide. And coming up from the south into Baghdad from the south as we went all the way around, coming up from Effingham, going into City Hall. We're here. And so forth. Next slide. Just a couple more. You know, this is my public affairs officer that's in the back. I'm taking pictures. This is what it looked like when the people came out. And I'm trying to gather their belongings and the equipment that the regime left. They were so happy. When I left, 99.9% of them were very glad that we're here. You know, very glad that we're here. Next slide. This is crossing the Euphrates, coming into the central banking district of Baghdad. On or about April 9th, I shook hands, met my counterparts in the Marines. They came up from the south along the Tigris. Next slide. And we basically handled POWs and so forth with respect and followed the guidelines. Next slide. And then basically the plan for us to secure central Baghdad initially. And very decentralized plans, but we were out there hooking his gap and making sure that the area was secure. The area that I had was the bank district. I showed up at the bank. Everyone said they worked at the bank. So there's money all over the place. You can imagine down here what it looked like. You can imagine this is the size of the building. So went in there, it's flooding out. We're getting the money out. $800 million in the back of my Bradley, that we had to pull out of there. U.S. greenbacks, $100 bills. You can imagine what that's like. That's not why I retired. That's why. Wow. Steve Mumford. April 14th, I'm in Central Baghdad, an artist, U.S. press credentials from the Army, and everything. I'm from art.com. I said, who are you here with? He goes, I'm not here with anybody. Jump aboard for 6 weeks, for 2 months. He drew pictures of my soldiers. They're now on display at a gallery in New York City, Postmaster's Gallery in Chelsea, award-winning. He was able to capture the essence of individual soldiers and what they're doing. This is one display of one of my scout platoons going downtown in the Baghdad. My wife and I were the guest of honor 2 weeks ago when they actually did the opening. And again, it was just an interesting, interesting people were there. I won't say anything more. Okay, next slide. Patrolling in Baghdad, still continues aggressiveness of our soldiers going out doing what our country has asked them to do. Next slide. Some of the palaces that Saddam Hussein's mother-in-law is out, so she looks pretty good. Next slide. Throughout an entire compound, that's the arches going into Baghdad. This is about April 9th when we first got in there. Next slide. And God loves himself. Next slide. And that's him again, believe it or not. I couldn't see the resemblance, but anyway, next slide. Some of the palace. Beautiful mosques throughout, a lot of historical Baghdad, gateway to civilization many years ago. A lot of, you know, multicultural country that still has the, you know, still has the uniqueness, and hopefully we'll be able to turn it around and get it going. Next slide. I spoke about Sergeant First Class Paul Smith. We recognized his tribute on April 7th when we rendered proper ceremony to him and so forth. Next slide. Alexis Barton, we're going to talk about that real quick. And next slide. And next slide. Next slide. And our sacrifice, their future. Hopefully that gives you a good overview from an individual that, that was there. And it took a little bit longer. Hopefully you guys are okay with that. I'd be more than honored to answer any questions. It's nice being here. It's great. Sure.
What could be done today to deal what would be your suggestion, or what has been done to deal with those effects on our troops, the mines and so on? It occurred to me that you showed us the picture of that huge...
Yeah, the huge minefield. Now they're more isolated minefields of, you know, disguised with trash and so forth. The more that we're on the offense, the better off we'll be. You know, the last couple of days and the last couple of weeks when we've actually heard that there was, you know, we're using artillery for the first time, you know, for the first time since the middle of April. We're using gunships, we're using rockets and so forth. The more that we're on the offense and the more that we do not allow them to take the initiative and we put them on the run, the better off it will be. And obviously people are going to be thinking twice when they do that. The more that we're moving and the more that we're patrolling in non-consistent routes, you know, going into different areas. You know, a lot of people ask me, you know, I mean, why are we guarding just standing in front of a building? Why don't we do things that are a little bit different besides stand on the building? Go to an intersection, you know, stop every BMW during that day or every vehicle that ends with a number 2, just to do those routine things and get away from the pattern. And I think that they were doing that. I think the president's sort of dissatisfied with a lot of the army, sending back the commander right now that went back to Tampa, you know, to get over there and finish the job. So I think that's what's happening.
Sir, with the level of resistance that you met, let's say, outside of the airport, but again, or more or less than you had expected based on intelligence?
Outside of the airport, I'm a little bit less, but I thought the welcome was going to be a little more friendly. You had a population of Shiites that were, I'm very concerned if we're there for good, you know, if we're there to get the job done. I don't mean for good, but, you know, we promised them a lot in 91. And, 6 months after the war, they were hanging off the balconies in hotels and, you know, in towns south of Baghdad. So they were a little bit, you know, leery. Are we going to stay the course? And they still are now. You know, very respectable population, meaning that they want to be part of the solution and they want to be part of the plan. And I think that, you know, now we're going in the right direction. That the president and Paul Bremer, you know, coming together and actually developing an end state. Here's the end state. Then working back from the end state back in order to develop those gates that are needed in order to accomplish those missions. I was there, you know, we turned over the municipal building to Ambassador Bodine, who was the first ambassador there inside Central Baghdad. She was, you know, she was in a meeting that was on boxes initially, and then by the time I left in May, we were in a room like this going, you know, planning the actual city structure inside Baghdad.
Do you have an opinion on the what appears to be a debate about establishing a provisional government in Iraq quickly, or maybe whether that should have been done in this room right after the cessation in Tuscany, versus this other longer drawn out process of developing some kind of successive government there.
I think you have to have a plan and you have to articulate the plan in order to make sure that the individuals that are part of the government are part of the solution. And, you know, we have to make the Iraqis feel confident in their abilities in order to transfer to a different form of government or a government that they want in order to establish. If we just tell them this is what you're going to do, we're not going to get it done. They're going to hate us. We need to make them feel part of the effort to make them a part of it. You know, I think that we definitely need to have an end state. We need to identify that and be able to articulate that so everybody understands. I guess that.
Well, this might be a trick question.
Yeah, sure.
Do you have any idea why the president and our government isn't saying exactly?
Okay, let me ask this to the great audience here. Who took Ari Fleischer's place? Who took Victoria's Clark's place? You know, there may be some individuals that know that. How we market and how we discuss that is very important. Okay, the minute that we do not get the American people involved in it and have a dynamic individual that's able to express his way outside of the hiring somebody that's just like you, a little bit different. So I think that we need to do a little bit better in how we articulate the plan and not really convincing the American people, but making them know and understand what's happening. Yes.
There's a lot of talk about a perceived lack of post-war planning, and I was just wondering, from your perspective as a commander, how that part of the training went. In other words, did they tell you to prepare for several months? How did they prepare for all the time?
Okay.
The battle.
Okay. We knew that we were going to have to go into Baghdad at one time. We worked on the individual skills in order to work on soldiers clearing buildings, working those technicalities. The challenge was, or not, not necessarily the problem was, that it went a lot quicker than expected. And, looking back, by concentrating on those basics that we concentrated on, those battle drills, those things, in order to make the soldiers more confident in their abilities, I think in the long run has made it more successful than if we had a little bit more time for planning. So I think in the long run, I think that, yes, we needed a plan. It would have been a gigantic confidence builder for us and my soldiers to know that they had that. I was not exposed to any plan. When I found out we were going to Baghdad, I was drawing on a map in my tactical operations center. You're going to go down this street, you're going to go down this street, but here's what you're going to do, coordinate with this unit. We were doing a lot of the efforts were very decentralized for us to have. But by making it more decentralized and by allowing us to concentrate on those basics, from marksmanship, from room clearing, I think we're definitely intangible combat multipliers that we don't even realize how much they contributed to the overall success. I think we're very successful in Baghdad. I think we're very successful in Iraq. We have to market our end state. What is the meaning of success that we have out there? Does that mean all we're hearing is how many Americans are dying? When we're not hearing, how many Iraqis are dying? I don't know if that was the first time that, a guy's dead, if he's walking down the street, on his past curfew. No questions yet. Reporters don't articulate that. Don't get that out. It's not sexy. The target generation between 50 and 70 years old is reading the New York Times, doesn't like to hear those words. It goes back to Vietnam and body counts and yada, yada, yada. But these kids that are over there, no one's sitting down. This is the people that we said, the slacker generation. They're going to sit down. They don't want to play sports. Unbelievable. It's time for us to stand up and finish what we began.
If I could follow up on that.
Sure.
Peter, this was outstanding. Thank you. As far as military culture,
mm-hmm.
actually, which is something that occurs on college campuses, which I'm directly involved in, especially
yeah.
on Asima, it's fabulous that you're going around
mm-hmm.
talking to college students. What is the reaction?
The reaction is complete silence.
Uh-huh.
They're not getting the information. I mean, it's fascination for what I'm showing them. Like, why aren't we hearing this? I mean, I spoke at Penn. I spoke at Bucknell. I was at Seton Hall yesterday. I mean, some people have a hard, my peers have a hard time. I'm not a bad guy, with me being able to be, to be approachable to talk about that. So I go out, and I've been doing that since I've been back. Since 1 November, all of my proceeds have gone to charity. And I think that it's very important with my integration back into my family. And I have a 1 and a 3-year-old. I mean, I miss them dearly, and I think about the families that were affected by this, and this is my contribution to make things a little bit better, but, you know, to have their family members perish, burned, or whatever, and feel a little bit better about what's going on. So back there.
Yeah, you talk about, a lot of people don't know that people like Sergeant Smith.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
There were some critics that said that the media failed the public. Although they're getting out information on statistics, deaths, and injuries,
yeah,
never see anybody, any American soldier injured. You never see them dead. You never see any of the gory pictures that would give the public a better idea of what it's really like to be in battle. And the question is, and these critics say that part of that is because it's being maneuvered by the administration. They don't want that to come out because then it becomes an anti-war kind of thing. Do you have any...
Well, I mean, besides the dead and that and dismembered Americans, you know, we're not showing dead Iraqis a lot. I do have some slides of that, but I won't bring that up. But I had embedded press with me that was very successful. The young generation and having that exposure to the press, they don't lie. They don't lie. They tell the story right from the gut, right from the heart. Okay, and that's what we needed to capture during the initial part of the war. April 15th, it completely changed. That group of reporters left on the first flight smoking. You know, they wanted to go home. They were in combat, time to go. You know, who's the next Wolf Blitzer or whatever. A new group of reporters came. You can imagine, you know, in the area, my area, the Palestine Hotel and the Sheraton Hotel was there. So you can imagine the next generation reporters coming in, high-paid taxi cab drivers, consultants that they're hiring from the locals, ex-police officers, you know, reporters huddling around Bearcat scanners trying to get out to make the sensational headline in order to get there. Getting back to your questions concerning the maneuvering, I think a lot of it is self-imposed from the press that I had. I will tell you that Carolyn Glick and Michael Corkery that were in my rally, they were talking, you know, directly back to Providence and Jerusalem as we spoke, you know, as we were fighting. I didn't let them say names or, you know, of the soldiers that I had died or the ones that were hurt seriously. I did that out of respect. But for the other information, you know, they had free and open access to it. So I think it was a good news story that the administration did with the embeddedness of the press. It was quite honest. It was, you know, it was right from the heart. Now, if we want to make an organized press structure, you know, hear the parting line by making, you know, the clone, this is my left hand, this is my right hand, what are your questions? And the young soldiers don't want. So, you know, so the synthesis of that press information was done by the press itself a lot of times. Sir, then right over here. Okay.
Called rules of engagement.
Yes.
These are very complex to me because I've never been in the service. Now, take for example, you see Iraqi running down the street with a television set. You know he's stolen it. You have a gun. You're an American Army. Right. You shoot him?
No.
Why not?
You don't shoot him because, number one, he's not a threat to you. The main effort is at that time you have to go through a rationale with that individual. A threat to your life or a threat to your unit's life. You know, that's the first thing. That's the first in any rules of engagement. Those rules could be adapted depending on the specific mission that you're given to. Some soldiers may have gotten a mission. You're in charge of to make sure that no looting is coming out of this building. You know, shoot the wound or shoot the alert at a different point. But, you know, throughout, you know, that, you know, now do we, you know, do we go after them and tackle them? 90% of the time, yes, in order to make it. But if you have the means to constrain that individual, you do that. If he throws a television at you, you shoot him, obviously.
What would you have done if you were taking artifacts out of the archives, the things the New York Times stuff?
And we read afterwards that they really didn't take a lot, but it was very, you know, that wasn't an embedded reporter that did that. How do we handle that? Obviously, we would tackle them, you know, and we would You know, I mean, all the, you know, all the front stuff and all the display stuff. You walk in there, oh my God, where did they get everything? It's like the Smithsonian. You know, it's the back room. That's the warehouse is full. You know, stuff. So really, it was one of the, you know, it's like the press. You know, the example the other day, right? Everybody heard 12 guys went AWOL when they came home. Everybody heard that. My God, they're leaving town.
Okay, but that,
yeah, compared to the percentage in World War II, a fraction. How it's fun is, you know, is how, you know, how it's important. That was, you know, that was the success story. Now I look at myself as a Department of Defense guy telling that. Okay, knowing the audience, how do you articulate that? You have a clone out there, well, today 12 guys went AWOL, but they walks out of the room. That's what's happening. You got some, you know, New York Times reporter or whatever, you know, and he's writing, oh my God, they're living in Lisbon Pros. It's the, you know, I mean, the sky is falling, the war's over, you know, whatever. Anyway, that's my thought process on that. Over here, sir.
Were you ordered specifically not to interfere with the looting?
No, not at all. I mean, we did everything we could in order to stop the looting. You know, I mean, but the main purpose of what I was doing when I got there initially was to destroy the threat. And the most threatening item to me was the Iraqi soldiers that were still intermingled in the neighborhood. So I had to focus on that, but my main effort was to ensure that I was getting to those key intersections, terrain, in order to put ambush positions in and so forth on that. So, but yeah, did it happen? Yeah. Imagine 15,000 people coming into Philadelphia, you know, and trying to secure it. I think the police department, we can't even deal with that, you know, it's like that. So. One more question. Okay, sir, somebody hasn't asked one before. Now, I'll hang around afterwards when we talk one-on-one.
Yeah, the military victory was very impressive.
Yes.
Seeing you here today, and I appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Part of the recent one.
Thanks.
Do you have a level of confidence in the plan now, the end-game plan as you described it, to have us disengage and turn over governance to a leadership that's going to be able to take charge?
Okay. Yes. How long are we going to be at it? You know, people ask me this, you know, how long are we going to be in Iraq? You know what I say? I say, a fraction of the time that we were in the Cold War. You know, everybody feels good about that. A fraction. What's one-fifth of 50 years? A long time. It's going to take time. And, you know, it's going to take efforts. I'm confident that the president and the administration, the Iran, that needs to be shaken up a little bit, you know, to get... I go around the contracting rules to get the right people there doing it rather than, you know, using the antiquated McNamara contracting rules out of the Pentagon and making some, you know, some organization that doesn't really, you know, work effectively because they're not charged of them because they come from another funding spot and I'm not going to listen to you and so forth. We need to probably grasp civilians or bring them in to, you know, to make it safe, to bring that, you know, to bring that. So, anyway. Okay, well, listen, thank you very much.
He asked me to express to you that
he has
still work.
Thanks for anything. Very much.